Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review, along with Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, we knew we'd be frustrated during the President's State of the Union address, but it's not often that we get frustration pretty much all the way through. I was just struck kind of how boring it was at times, and then also just how shameless it was at times. Somehow the president, who won't do the Keystone Pipeline, is all for shale exploration. And that's the explanation why we can afford to dump hundreds of millions into failed businesses like Solyndra. But the big message, of course, that he had all night was, we want to do all these things, and we're going to make millionaires and billionaires pay for it. So here's a couple of clips, if you can stomach them, from the president on a couple different concepts here.
Do we want to keep these tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, or do we want to keep our investments in everything else, like education and medical research, a strong military, and care for our veterans? Because if we're serious about paying down our debt, we can't do both.
So there's the choice, Jim. We can either do things that are important for the country, or rich people can get tax cuts. If the rich people keep their tax cuts, we can't do any of that. And here's his explanation for what folks should have to pay.
Tax reform should follow the Buffett rule. If you make more than $1 million a year, you should not pay less than 30% in taxes. If you make under $250,000 a year, like 98% of American families, your taxes shouldn't go up.
Plenty to say there, too, Jim. I'm always fascinated by the $750,000 gap. We know what the millionaires have to do, and we know what those under $250,000 would get under his plan. But he never tells the folks between $250,000 and $1 million that they're in the same boat as the millionaires. So a great job of smoke and mirrors and class warfare, and it's pretty much what we expected.
Well, let's give Obama a little bit of credit, Greg. He did clock it in at only 4 hours and 59 minutes. So at least that's how long it seemed to go on. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it was kind of fascinating. I was on Twitter last night, and just the level of cynicism and exhaustion and tiredness amongst our crowd, shall we say, of conservative writers and bloggers and like people, we really have outrage fatigue. Everyone could kind of pretty much tell exactly what we were going to get. Early on, it came across that this was going to be a very combative, very populist, very much like a campaign speech in front of, you know, on within the Capitol, with taxpayers paying for it all. Greg, did you encounter anything in there that would not have fit in a Democratic convention acceptance speech?
Oh, not at all.
Right down to the, you know, semi-inspiring invocation of the Navy SEALs at the beginning and the end. You know, it basically was, you know, hey, you know who else doesn't have a job right now? Osama bin Laden. and the thing that kind of jumped out at me, look, we could spend like several hours talking about how terrible this was, and it would still go by quicker than the actual speech. But his closing note was that we should look to the SEAL team that whacked bin Laden as a role model for national unity and common purpose. And it's undoubtedly this stirred all the right chords, and I'm sure a lot of viewers. But do you realize Obama's role model for a representative democracy is the government's very, very finest team of killers? You know what? They're different things set up for different purposes. I don't know if I want the top levels of the federal government working like the Navy SEALs. You know, if the Navy SEALs have dissent or discussion or debate during their mission, they'll die. So obviously they all follow orders and operate directly the same. But, you know, the whole point of – it's not surprising that Obama's closing message to Congress would be, why can't you guys follow my orders and execute the way the Navy SEALs do? And, you know, considering the way he views the presidency, the way he uses executive orders, the way he ignores Congress and makes recess appointments when Congress isn't in recess, et cetera, I suppose we shouldn't be surprised. It's kind of fascinating that if George W. Bush had made the exact same metaphor, people would be invoking 7 days in May and the idea that a military coup has occurred and that that the President Bush does not believe in co-equal branches of government, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, usually, Jim, you can't disagree with the schmaltzy metaphor at the end of the State of the Union or any
joint session speech.
But, you know, obviously these guys work well as a team. Obviously they follow orders. But you know what they're also really good at? Surviving, doing things on their own, being able to adapt to any situation, which is also great about America. And every small business owner and people across the country, yes, they're part of America, but they just want the government to get the heck out of the way, not just be part of some, you know, kumbaya moment from this administration who doesn't think that anybody can do anything for themselves.
You know, Mr. President, you did promise to put two bullets into the head of the deficit. And that mission remains incomplete.
In case anybody couldn't tell, we actually started with the bad martini. That felt that was self-explanatory. But let's move on to the good martini. And that was the Republican response from Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. And everybody knows that it's tough to be the party out of power in this situation. You know, the grand trappings of the House chamber. A lot of people don't even bother to keep their TV tuned on to the State of the Union by the time the chamber clears out and you actually get to the opposition response. But Mitch Daniels did a fantastic job. It wasn't flowery. It wasn't all charisma. And you're probably not going to want that from Mitch Daniels anyway, because that's not his natural thing. He was just very sober, very factual in explaining what was wrong with America, that we weren't all that strong, that we were in a grave economic condition despite the president's smoke and mirrors job. And then he went after the president on the tax policy, which we talked about before. And this was great.
It's absolutely so that everyone should contribute to our national recovery, including, of course, the most affluent among us. There are smart ways and dumb ways to do this. The dumb way is to raise rates in a broken, grossly complex tax system, choking off growth without bringing in the revenues we need to meet our debts. The better course is to stop sending the wealthy benefits they do not need and stop providing them so many tax preferences that distort our economy and do little or nothing to foster growth.
And Jim, I think Mitch Daniels did a good job of pointing out to the American people that House Republicans have actually passed a lot of bills that would foster an environment for job creation, but the Democratic Senate and President Obama will have nothing to do with it. But to me, using no euphemisms other than "this is dumb" is a very direct way to rebut the president.
Greg, I really like to think that in a better world, not only would, you know, Mitch Daniels be running for president, but everyone in Washington would have this particular style, in the sense that there's nothing sexy about Mitch Daniels. No offense to Mrs. Daniels. There's no glitz, no glamour, no showmanship. The Black Eyed Peas are never going to make a music video about him. You know, the 3-6 Mafia are never going to cite him in their lyrics. You know, but instead, he just, you know, I was tweeting as I was watching this. "Hi, I'm Mitch Daniels. I am way too boring to be BSing you. Hey, you know what? You haven't liked anything I've said in the past 2 minutes. And you know what? That's how you know I'm being honest." Hard truths. No smoke and mirrors. It was exactly what we needed. I've liked Mitch Daniels for a long time. I think he's a really good guy who, you know, chose not to run for president. I realize his style is not necessarily everybody's preferred choice. I realize that he's not necessarily, you know, he's a social conservative who did not, when he was thinking about running, did not want to make his campaign about social things. But he's done a fantastic job in Indiana of limiting state government, cutting where it can. His nickname is the Blade. You know, you could not come up with a greater contrast with President Obama. And it was just, you know, it was a fantastic response, but there was a little bit of heartbreak that nobody in the Republican field really could kind of hit those chords the way he did. So, you know, in some better alternate universe, all of our politicians are competent and straightforward and direct and not all that exciting with glitz or glamour. You know, Mitch Daniels last night illustrated just how overrated charisma is in government. And that sounds like an insult, but that really is like the highest compliment I can pay the guy, is that, you know, it's, you know, competence is such a refreshing, you know, breath of fresh air.
Yeah, substance over nothing but style is what we got last night. Unfortunately, we had to listen to the style with no substance for over 65 minutes. But anyway, let's move on to a little bit of the presidential campaign trail and the crazy martini. And on Tuesday, we got pretty much what we expected in those 2 years' worth of tax returns released by Mitt Romney, you know, 2010 and the estimated for 2011. He makes a lot of money. He made most of his money on investment. He gives a lot of money to charity, and a lot of that money goes to the Mormon Church. I don't think that surprises anyone. Yet, even though he makes far less than John Kerry did in 2004 and still makes today, apparently Mitt Romney's tax returns show a guy who's completely out of touch and part of the 1% and can't possibly relate to someone who's struggling with job loss right now, even though he's actually done that in the private sector. Yet at the same time, when the president's cabinet back in 2009, whether it was Daschle or Geithner or Sebelius, just basically not paying taxes, apparently this is a much bigger story, that a guy who honestly pays his taxes made a bit more money and paid at a lower rate because of how he made it for that year.
One, the marvel at the outrage over Mitt Romney for paying his taxes and the lack of outrage over Tim Geithner not paying his taxes. I just got to observe. So, you know, Mitt Romney pays 15%, and it's because, you know, he's probably one of the very few Americans who had zero income last year. meaning Mitt Romney does not make a salary. His job, and I'm making air quotes as I say this, is running for president, and all of his money comes from investments. Well, you know, and so basically that's why he's paying close to the 15% level. Now, a lot of people will see this, including Democrats, and say, how dare this, You know, and the problem is that so basically they're saying, like, well, okay, we you know, how dare somebody who makes all their money through investments make, you know, pay less in taxes than people who pay much, you know, pay who get their money from salary. There are two ways you can do this. You can lower income taxes to 15%, which obviously I think we'd all enjoy, or you can raise investment taxes to 30%, which is what Obama said in his State of the Union. Think about it. That's effectively doubling the tax on investment. Now, basically, the entire argument from Obama, the left, and even the other Republicans who are beating the drum on Romney's taxes, basically they are all working together to finally save America from the dreadful scourge of investment. Don't you feel good, Greg? We're going to finally stop that terrible, terrible investment that's been holding us back all these years. Finally, we will stop it, and America without investment will rise. And, you know, you can only imagine the state of the economy at that point. I just, you know, I am beyond myself. Like, we have our crazy martinis to finish this up, and then we have, like, just our surreal, the world has spun off its axis, nothing makes sense anymore. And I feel a need for a fourth martini in circumstances like that.
Yeah, you do need those on some days. And as Romney pointed out, you know, the money I initially invested, I earned in a salary at one point, and it was actually the business tax that he ended up paying, which is pretty hefty. I believe it's one of the highest in the world. So don't think that Mitt Romney hasn't contributed his quote-unquote fair share to the U.S. Treasury over the years. And his bill, even at that 15% rate, is still more than about half the country combined paid in income taxes last year. So,
Greg, I mean, you know, with the amount of money Romney paid in taxes last year, you could probably pay for the airfare to fly Michelle Obama to Spain like 18 times. Just for perspective on costs and benefit and who's kicking you in and all that stuff.
Jim, an amazing day. Rest up. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.